This is SBS World News Radio. I'm Murray Silby.
And I'm Michael Tomalaris. Coming up tonight, the rhetoric between the United States and North Korea raised another notch.
Because this comes from the current President of the United States, this is clearly a declaration of war.
Also this evening, a big turnout by Iraqi Kurds for a controversial independence referendum and...
I think it's well known that within my family, we have people that sit on the other side of the fence.
A daughter of prominent No campaigner Tony Abbott releases a video urging people to vote yes in the same-sex marriage survey.
Those stories and more in the next 30 minutes.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock with the news. I'm Mike Tomalaris. South Korea has called for calm after North Korea threatened to shoot US planes in the region out of the sky. North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho says Donald Trump has declared war on the country and it is prepared to take defensive action. The White House says it would be absurd to suggest the president's controversial speech to the United Nations last week amounted to a declaration of war. Spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders says the United States is focused on a diplomatic solution.
It's never appropriate for a country to shoot down another country's aircraft when it's over international waters. Our goal is still the same. We continue to seek the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's our focus, doing that through both the most maximum economic and diplomatic pressures as possible at this point.
The federal government has revealed last financial year's budget deficit came in at $33.2 billion, down from the $37.6 billion predicted in the May budget. Treasurer Scott Morrison has attributed the better-than-expected figure to spending cuts with a $5 billion reduction in social services payments. Mr. Morrison says the government has been able to keep expenditure under control.
We have had to deal with changes to what has happened on revenue, but all along the line, we've been holding firm to keeping expenditure under control, and we've been doing that by having sensible and constructive forecasts and realistic estimates of where things are going. That is one of the key reasons why Australia to date has been able to maintain our credit rating, because we have been transparent about this process, we have been realistic.
According to the Treasurer, from the end of July next year, the government won't have to borrow money to pay for welfare and everyday spending in health and education, as revenue will be enough to cover expenses. The states have hit back at the Prime Minister over his call to fast-track gas projects to tackle a shortage that's even worse than feared. Malcolm Turnbull has received two reports showing the expected shortfall in gas for 2018 is more than three times larger than forecast earlier this year. Mr. Turnbull has threatened to trigger export controls if gas companies fail to make more domestic supply available. He has criticised New South Wales for not moving quickly to ease restrictions and approve the Narrabri gas project, and Victoria for its moratorium on conventional and coal seam gas exploration. New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian says the approvals process for the project is progressing. Deputy Labor Leader Tanya Plibersek says Mr. Turnbull needs to take action as soon as possible.
Now he keeps threatening to pull the trigger. He keeps raising it as a possibility and then backing down in the face of pressure from his gas company mates. We know that households and businesses in Australia are doing it tough. People are seeing their energy bills go up and up and up, and businesses are actually threatening closure. They're talking about moving offshore because they can't afford their energy prices. That's what we need to address right now, not next year or the year after, but right now.
Victoria's Labor government says the state has always produced more gas than it consumes and dared Mr. Turnbull to immediately enact restrictions on gas exports. About two dozen asylum seekers have left the Manus Island detention centre as part of Australia's resettlement deal with the United States. The Refugee Action Coalition says about 22 people, including Sudanese, Afghan, Rohingya and Iranian refugees, have been taken to Port Moresby. The group, along with three others already in the Papua New Guinea capital, will be flown to the US tomorrow. Up to 1,250 refugees held in Australian detention centres will be offered residency in the US as part of an agreement made with former US President Barack Obama late last year. Australia is to resettle several dozen Central American refugees who are expected to arrive in the country within weeks. And the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, says the deal is a sign of Australia's strong relationship with the United States. Former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's daughter has spoken out about the division in her family over the same-sex marriage issue. Mr. Abbott and his sister Christine Foster are leading campaigners for rival sides in the debate. In a video released by the Yes campaign, Frances Abbott talks about Christine and her aunt's partner, Virginia Edwards.
You can't help who you fall in love with. I look at Auntie Chris and I don't think she planned to fall in love with Virginia. It just happened. It never really changed anything. She was still Auntie Chris. Well, I think it's well known that within my family we have people that sit on the other side of the fence. It really just doesn't make sense to me that it's not allowed.
A quick look at the weather forecast now for tomorrow, Wednesday. Perth, shower or two, 17. Adelaide, partly cloudy, 23 degrees. In Melbourne, a possible shower, 23. In Canberra, late rain, 24. Sydney, partly cloudy, 25. Brisbane, more cloud, 26. And Murray, more on these stories coming up on SBS World News at 6:30.
Thanks, Mike. Across Australia, this is SBS World News Radio. It's 6:07. I'm Murray Silby. Tensions between North Korea and the United States just keep escalating, with the North Korean foreign minister again lashing out at US President Donald Trump. Despite the United Nations' best efforts, neither side appears willing to back down. Matt Kennellan reports.
United States President Donald Trump has a history of tweeting his thoughts without any apparent hesitation. But a tweet on the weekend that said North Korea would not be around much longer appears to have pushed tensions between the two countries to a new level. North Korea's Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho says Mr. Trump has, in fact, declared war.
그러나 트럼프는 지난 주말에 또다시
Last weekend, Trump claimed that our leadership would not be around much longer and hence at last declared war on us. Because this comes from the current President of the United States, this is clearly a declaration of war. All the member states participating in the United Nations General Assembly and the whole world should remember that it was the US who first declared war on our country.
It's the latest development in a near-constant escalation of the rhetoric between the two nations. With the threat of nuclear warfare looming large, each step is being watched closely. The US military exercised a show of force when it flew bombers in international airspace over waters east of North Korea, or the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. The Pentagon says it was the furthest north of the demilitarized zone that US fighter jets or bombers have flown this century. It led Mr. Ri to offer this stark warning.
Since the United States declared war on us, we will have every right to take countermeasures, including the right to shoot down United States strategic bombers, even when they are not inside the airspace border of our country. In light of the declaration of war by Trump, all options will be on the operations table of the supreme leadership of the DPRK.
The United States was quick to denounce Mr. Ri's comments. White House spokeswoman Sarah Sanders has described the allegation of a U.S. declaration of war as absurd.
It's never appropriate for a country to shoot down another country's aircraft when it's over international waters. Our goal is still the same. We continue to seek the peaceful denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. That's our focus, doing that through both the most maximum economic and diplomatic pressures as possible at this point.
But the increasing tension has the United States worried. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warns the rise in rhetoric increases the risk of miscalculation and misunderstanding. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric explains.
When you have the rise of tension, the rise of rhetoric, so does the risk of miscalculations. Fiery talk can lead to fatal misunderstandings. We would want to reiterate that the only solution for this is a political solution, and I would also reiterate the Secretary General's call for statesmanship, which he delivered in their General Assembly.
The detection of mysterious seismic activity in North Korea has stirred further concerns over the country's nuclear ambitions. Last week, it threatened to test a hydrogen bomb over the Pacific Ocean before Ri Yong-ho said targeting the US mainland with rockets was inevitable. US Defence Secretary Jim Mattis says such a test would be what he calls a shocking display of irresponsibility.
There has not been a detonation like that above ground. I don't even remember 35 years. Don't quote me on the number of years. This would be a shocking display of irresponsibility toward global health, towards stability, towards non-proliferation.
US Defence Secretary Jim Mattis ending that report by Matt Connellan. A daughter of former Prime Minister Tony Abbott has released a video distancing herself from her father's views on same-sex marriage and urging a yes vote in the postal survey. Mr. Abbott is a high-profile critic of same-sex marriage, but his daughter Frances says she was raised to stand up for what she believes in. Natasha Kallios reports.
The Abbott family debate over the right to same-sex marriage has been thrown back into the spotlight, with daughter Frances Abbott backing the Yes campaign in a video. Ms. Abbott talks about her aunt, Christine Forster, and says she would like to be present at and a part of her aunt's wedding. In the video, she says legalising same-sex marriage would make society a much better place.
You can't help who you fall in love with. Love just happens sometimes and it's unexpected, and that's kind of what's the awesome thing about it. I look at Auntie Chris and I don't think she planned to fall in love with Virginia. It just happened. It never really changed anything. She was still Auntie Chris. She's still going to be at Christmas. She's still going to be at the family barbecues. Her children are still my cousins. This is why it really just doesn't make sense to me that it's not allowed.
Ms. Abbott says legalising same-sex marriage would lead to less fear of discrimination, less isolation and loneliness. Tony Abbott is campaigning heavily against same-sex marriage. The former Prime Minister's sister, Ms. Forster, a Liberal councillor for the City of Sydney, is campaigning for a yes vote. Ms. Abbott explains in the video why she is stepping forward to support that position, despite her father's view on the subject.
Well, I think it's well known that within my family we have people that sit on the other side of the fence. My mother and my father raised me to stand up for what I believe in.
Meanwhile, Brisbane Catholic Archbishop Mark Coleridge has criticised the language being used in the same-sex marriage debate. He says while same-sex couples' love must be respected, society has always discriminated towards some forms of marriage.
I am concerned to clarify the language, and I don't think it's enough to say that love is love. It is about love, but there's only one form of love, the many forms of love that we call marriage, and that is between a man and a woman, supposedly lifelong and supposedly open to children.
Archbishop Coleridge says while it is his responsibility to convey knowledge about the debate to fellow Catholics, he does not want to give same-sex couples a difficult time. He says their dignity must be respected.
Natasha Kallios with that report. This is SBS World News Radio with Murray Silby. It's a 6:15, still to come.
I am so happy. I wanted to be one of the first ones here. I only slept for 3 hours. This is a historic day for us.
A big turnout by Iraqi Kurds for a controversial independence referendum. That's still to come on SBS World News Radio. You're listening to SBS World News Radio with Murray Silby. It's 16 minutes past six. Iraqi Kurds have cast their votes in an historic referendum in what they see as a major step towards a long-cherished dream of statehood. But amid widespread international concern, Iraq's Prime Minister has denounced the move as unconstitutional. Maya Jamison reports.
Crowds of Iraqi Kurds celebrated the referendum vote in downtown Erbil after polling stations closed. An estimated 5.2 million eligible voters in the three northern provinces of Erbil, Sulaymaniyah and Dohuk cast their votes. After the high turnout, many were euphoric.
I am so happy. I wanted to be one of the first ones here. I only slept for 3 hours. This is a historic day for us.
I have voted in presidential and parliamentarian elections before, but this is the most important one because it's about independence. I hope the new Kurdistan state will be a state for everyone. Kurds, Arabs, Assyrians, Yazidis, everyone who needs safety and wants to live in freedom.
Other areas outside the region known as the disputed areas also cast their votes in around 2,000 polling centres. The voters chose either yes to an independent Kurdish state or no to remain an autonomous region of Iraq. The vote had been peaceful, but in the disputed oil-rich city of Kirkuk, security forces took to the streets as the vote proceeded, fearing it could alienate Turkmen and Arabs there. The vote is not binding and is not expected to result in independence anytime soon. But the Prime Minister of the Kurdistan Regional Government, Netivan Barzani, who was among those spearheading the campaign, has hailed the vote as historic.
Today is a historical day for the communities that live in this country, Kurdistan. Our message is that the Kurdish people, along with the other communities that live here, want to live peacefully and democratically, and they want to express their opinion on their future and on the future of this country. This referendum does not mean that we will declare the independence of Kurdistan the next day, and nor is it to identify the borders of the Kurdistan region. These two issues are very important, and all our neighbours in Baghdad must understand this. We just want to show the world what our people want.
But it comes amid widespread international concern. UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has expressed worry about the potential destabilising effect of the referendum. The United States and Iran have joined the Iraqi government in repeatedly rejecting it and its results, with Iraq describing it as unconstitutional. Australia too has said the time is not right for the referendum, while Britain says it risks instability when the focus should be on defeating IS. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has gone further, warning Turkey, which fears the effects on its own Kurdish population, could shut its border in the area.
Nobody should expect us to close our eyes to a new crisis and clashes zone near our borders, 350 kilometres. Our attitude on this issue is very clear. Regardless of its results, we call this referendum, which is not in conformity with the current law in Iraq, null and void. We call it illegitimate.
And in neighbouring Syria, Assistant Foreign Minister Ayman Sosan maintains the referendum harms the sovereignty of Iraq as well as the Kurdish people.
One of the basic rules of the international law is safeguarding country's sovereignty, territorial integrity and peace. So the referendum held by some extremists has negative impact on Iraq. Although the Kurds may find it good, they are still Iraqi people.
Syria's Assistant Foreign Minister Ayman Sosan ending that report by Maya Jamison. This is SBS World News Radio. It's 20 minutes past six. Still to come, new technology is helping paleontologists dig up some of Australia's ancient secrets.
This is the ultimate cold case, hundreds of thousands of years of time, and we're trying to work out who done it, if you like. So we record the minute details of the position of each bone, but now we can do that with a laser scanner.
That's still to come on SBS World News Radio. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has sprung a surprise, calling a snap election for next month. The move comes in the wake of North Korea sharply stepping up its nuclear program. An air of uncertainty Mr. Abe appears to be hoping to utilise at the ballot box, Matt Connellan reports.
With an approval rating up to around 50%, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has decided to seize the moment. Mr. Abe has announced he will dissolve the parliament's lower house later this week and call a snap election a year early. The 63-year-old is the third longest-serving prime minister in post-war Japan after 5 years on the job. Mr. Abe says he is making the move to resolve what he calls a national crisis.
Shinpaku suru, kyachosen jousei.
In a national crisis with a shrinking and aging population, as well as a tense situation with North Korea, I'd like to stand on the front line and exercise strong leadership to deal with this national crisis. Election, which is the basis of democracy, should not be swayed by North Korea's threat. Rather, I believe we need to call an election and get approval from the public for the countermeasure against the North Korea issue.
Mr. Abe insists the decision to call the election will not distract his government from responding to North Korean threats. Indeed, he has pledged to increase pressure if North Korea fails to halt its missile and nuclear weapons development. Mr. Abe hasn't always been so popular. As recently as July, opinion polls suggested support for the Prime Minister had dropped to as low as 30%. He was facing accusations he had exploited his political power to help a long-term friend. But as tensions with North Korea have grown, Mr. Abe's support has too, with his vocal stance on Japan's neighbour and rival proving popular. He says it is imperative that maximum pressure is applied on the North Korean government.
We need to urge North Korea to abolish all its nuclear weapons in a verifiable and irreversible way. Unless North Korea accepts that, we have no choice but to continue to increase pressure in all sorts of ways to its maximum level.
Politically, Mr. Abe is also taking advantage of the opposition's disarray. The opposition Democratic Party went through the tumultuous leadership resignation of Renho Murata in July and has suffered several recent defections. However, Mr. Abe faces a fresh challenge in his former Liberal Democratic Party cabinet member, Tokyo Governor Yuriko Koike. Ms. Koike enjoys wide popularity, and she announced earlier this week her intention to form a new national political party. Her local party trumped Mr. Abe's LDP in the metropolitan election in Tokyo. Ms. Koike became the city's first female governor, momentum she's hoping to exploit at the national level. Her problem, though, is her policies are similar to Mr. Abe's. A political expert from Sophia University in Tokyo, Tina Barrett, explains.
In the elections in July in Tokyo, her party took many votes away from the LDP. But I think for a lot of voters, the party that she will form will probably just be an LDP light, and therefore for a lot of voters it may not be particularly attractive.
Ms. Koike will not run for a seat in the lower house herself. Instead, she will use her popularity to campaign for her party's candidates as they try to win some of the 475 lower house seats. If current opinion polls are reflected at the ballot box on October the 22nd, it would put Mr. Abe on track to becoming the country's longest-serving post-war political leader.
Matt Connellan with that report. You're listening to SBS World News Radio. I'm Murray Silby. Good to have your company. New technology is helping paleontologists dig up some of Australia's ancient secrets. Researchers from the University of Adelaide hope to learn more about the mass extinction of megafauna thousands of years ago. Their findings could shed light on what will happen on our planet in the future. Our South Australia correspondent Rhiannon Elston reports.
Liz Reed has spent the last 20 years digging for answers in the giant underground Narrecourt cave system in South Australia. The vertebrate paleontologist based at the University of Adelaide wants to know how and when Australia's megafauna died out thousands of years ago.
This is the ultimate cold case, hundreds of thousands of years of time, and we're trying to work out who done it, if you like. So we record the minute details of the position of each bone, but now we can do that with a laser scanner.
The Narrecourt cave system, she says, holds a rare deposit of fossils. Their state of preservation and the time period that they belong to makes it unique on a global scale. The main fossil bed where Dr. Reed has spent much of her career is just a few metres under the ground. More than 130 species have fallen through a hole in the earth above over thousands of years. And the dry, stable environment of the South Australian Narrecourt cave system has kept them there.
They've preserved these deposits like tombs that have just been shut. So we see things like completely articulated skeletons of these extinct animals, almost like where they laid down and took their last breath.
Some of the remains belong to long extinct species like the marsupial lion and giant kangaroo. The fossil bed is providing scientists with a near continuous window into 500,000 years of life. Scientists hope they'll soon know a lot more about these creatures and their environment. A $2 million research grant will see a frenzy of activity over the next 4 years, led by University of Adelaide researchers and supported by the local council, the South Australian Museum and the state government. As University of Adelaide PhD student Martin Anker explains, the funding will help provide new tools to map and date the fossils in incredible detail and shed more light on their history than ever before.
Laser scanners have been around for a while, but in the last 10 years they've really come of age. They enable far more detail to be captured than previous techniques such as cave surveys, tape measures.
Liz Reed says finding out what happened during mass extinctions in the past could be critically important in preserving species in the future.
I think it's really important because extinction is something which is very real today. Many people say we're facing the next wave of extinctions, and the beauty of the Narracourt deposits is we're dealing with, for the most part, animals that are still alive today. So if we study those and these lost giants and see how they responded to climate and even the arrival of people into Australia, it gives us a window into potentially the future and how we can work towards conserving species today.
Narracourt Lucendale Council Mayor Erica Vickery has been visiting the caves since she was a child. She's looking forward to the rest of the world discovering their cultural and scientific value.
I think that we are in an absolutely unique position to have the World Heritage Site here, and now to have this extra research being done, which will have a big impact, I think, on climate change knowledge of the animals that were here years ago. I don't think there's too many communities in the whole world that have this.
The caves can be toured by the public for a fee. Those who visit will find a 500,000-year record of the past with many more secrets to share.
That report by Rhiannon Elston. Now, before we go, a final check of today's main stories. Israeli officials say a Palestinian gunman has killed at least three Israelis and critically wounded a fourth in the Jerusalem Hills town of Ha'adar. A World War I centenary memorial service has been held in Belgium to commemorate the Battle of Polygon Wood. And Mexico's chief of emergency services says authorities will continue searching for another 3 days for survivors of a deadly September 19 earthquake, though it's unlikely anyone else will be found alive. That's SBS World News Radio for now. You can see Sarah Arbo and Michael Tomalaris on SBS World News tonight. SBS News and features are online for you at any time at sbs.com.au/news. I'm Murray Silby, and thanks for listening.